Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing concern that the biggest political story since the Watergate scandal, the Russian interference in our elections and the yet-to-be-explained connections between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin, is in the process of disappearing from the political media landscape in Washington as the daily antics of Donald Trump distract the public and consume the news cycle. David Korn, the Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, joins us to discuss his latest article at Mother Jones, The Mysterious Disappearance of the Biggest Scandal in Washington, and the concerns that political appointees to head up the CIA and the DNI, along with a partisan chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee who worked on the Trump campaign, could slow walk the inquiry into a political graveyard unless sufficient Democratic and grassroots pressure is brought to bear and sustained. Then Kenneth Briggs, a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor who writes for the National Catholic Reporter, joins us to discuss the alliance between Trump's chief strategist, Stephen Bannon, and hardliners in the Vatican who oppose Pope Francis. We'll examine Bannon's friendship with the conservative traditionalist American Cardinal Raymond Burke, who the Pope fired as head of the Knights of Malta, an elite secret society whose theological underpinnings go back to the Crusades and align with Bannon's apocalyptic vision of an impending war with Islam. Then finally, we'll speak with Andrew Fass, an author, activist, philanthropist, and management advisor promoting psychologically healthy, safe, and fair workplaces. He joins us to discuss his new book, From Bully to Bullseye, Move Your Organization Out of the Line of Fire. And we will assess the extent to which Senator Elizabeth Warren is a victim of bullying or just old-fashioned misogyny and male chauvinism in Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's put-down and shut-up of her on the Senate floor, and whether Donald Trump is a bully when he threatens to destroy someone's career, supposedly in jest. And joining us now is David Korn, the Washington Bureau Chief at Mother Jones Magazine. He's written for numerous publications and is a talk show regular. His best-selling books include Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin, Scandal, and the Selling of the Iraq War. And his latest article at Mother Jones is The Mysterious Disappearance of the Biggest Scandal in Washington. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Korn.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, David. And I would think that already, we can't say this is thoroughly proven, but when the entire 16 intelligence services of the United States form a consensus and say that Russia was involved in the elections in terms of meddling, influencing, and these efforts through their intelligence services were directed by Vladimir Putin himself, you would think that the American people would see that as an attack on the very institution of democracy itself. And this is, without getting too hyperbolic, it's a kind of political Pearl Harbor. Why this strange lack of indignation and political passion?
I'm the wrong person to ask because I'm as puzzled as you are. I've been writing about this since, before the election. And I think, there may be, some limited explanations, but we have overwhelming consensus presented to us by the U.S. government, by intelligence agencies, of the finding that you just put forward, that there was hacking, and that it was done purposefully under Putin's order as part of a widespread comprehensive plan to affect the U.S. election in order to benefit Donald Trump, the fellow who won. We saw the results of the hacking during the campaign. I've talked to people on the Hillary Clinton campaign and at the DNC who've told me how effective it was. Having to deal every day with several thousand new emails being released, if you're at the DNC or on a presidential campaign in the throes of the last few weeks of a campaign, is really a big burden to carry while you're trying to win. I'm not saying this is the only reason why Hillary Clinton lost, but it certainly created problems for her campaign and for the Democratic Party apparatus that was supporting her. I mean, I think these are things that are more or less undeniable. So that all said, we saw during the campaign season that the Obama administration had what I think can fairly be called a muted response to this, even though independent contractors hired by the DNC had resolved by June or July that Russia was behind the hacks that were happening that only targeted Democrats, at least in terms of information released. The Obama administration did not attack Russia or Putin, did not make a big stink out of this until October 7th, when not the White House, but the Office of the National Director of Intelligence and the Department of Homeland Security put out a statement saying that, yes, the consensus is that Russia's behind this. And at the White House, Josh Hermes, the press secretary, merely said that Obama would be taking actions that would be proportionate, but they didn't say what, and it was very, again, it was sort of muted. Now, why did they do this? Obama people will tell you that they believed that, Hillary was going to win and that they didn't want to get into a major cyber war against Russia, where perhaps we may be more vulnerable than Russia is, and that they didn't want to, give Donald Trump something else to complain about when he was already saying that the election was being rigged against him. Was this the right call? I think in retrospect, it clearly wasn't, and it played into Putin's hands. Now, that's before the election. After the election, the evidence became even more, I think, compelling, and the intelligence services went even further in saying that this was done purposefully to benefit Donald Trump. Yet, the Republicans don't want to talk about it. They control the powers of government. Donald Trump has not, for months have not acknowledged this. And then when he finally did in January, he downplayed the importance, saying that everybody hacks everybody, so it's no big deal. He, of course, doesn't want to have his election delegitimized or tainted. And I think the Democrats quite, I think it's quite obvious that they did not force the issue as much as they should have. They were shell-shocked after the election. They didn't, Hillary didn't want to look like a sore loser. The Democrats on the Hill did not make as big a protest and demand investigations as vociferously as they should have. They're doing that now, but there was a long time of, there was silence. And I think a lot of Americans, particularly those who voted for Hillary Clinton, who have the majority of the electorate, were wondering, where are the Democrats, in looking at this issue in which an election was stolen? Well, not stolen, but certainly subverted by Russia. And it seems in return, the new president isn't doing anything to protect future U.S. elections from similar mucking about. And in fact, he just seems to be rewarding Putin these days. So it's all, I say this not as an excuse, but to explain. But even with this explanation, I still am puzzled by why reporters, pundits, commentators, elected officials, D's and R's in Washington are not screaming louder to get answers to this. And this is not even getting into the issue of whether there were improper contacts between the Trump campaign or people associated with Donald Trump and Russia during the campaign, the whole year before the election. It seems the FBI has collected information on this. We don't know what it is. We don't know to what depth they've investigated this. But, we know about the Hillary Clinton email investigation, but we don't know about the Trump-Russia investigation. And now there's an investigation being conducted by the Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee, both being run by, run by Republicans. And there's no indication of how thorough or how far those investigations may go.
And again, I'm speaking with David Korn, the Washington Bureau Chief at Mother Jones Magazine. He's written for numerous publications and is a talk show regular, and his best-selling books include Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin Scandal and the Selling of the Iraq War. And his latest article at Mother Jones is The Mysterious Disappearance of the Biggest Scandal in Washington. And of course, during the campaign, Donald Trump actually exhorted the Russians to hack. He called upon them to hack. He praised WikiLeaks. And the first revelation of the existence of the private server that dogged Hillary Clinton throughout the campaign and was revived at the very end by the FBI Director James Comey, that emerged because of a hack into Sid Blumenthal's emails revealing the service. And then, as a public service in March of 2003, RT broke that story, RT being the English language propaganda outlet of Russia, of Putin's. So this is the fingerprints go back quite a way. And now, of course, you have, I mean, for example, I'm mystified as to why I get so much hate mail from American leftists who say that you're essentially McCarthy, you're indulging in McCarthyism and warmongering for criticizing Putin. And you've got people at The Intercept who are invested in Assange and Snowden, who make these charges. The couple that run the Nation magazine also make these charges. Norman Solomon, etc. So what's going on here with the American left? Because if there was any ideological consistency with leftists, they would be supporting the Russian Communist Party, not this capitalist gangster in Moscow.
I have no belief with Putin. I don't like hawkish, knee-jerk anti-Russian, opposition or aggression from the neocons in Washington. And I do believe that we need to find ways to work with Russia on nuclear nonproliferation, like we do with the Iran deal and other ways. And that, you don't want to demonize any government when it comes to, the sort of multilateral cooperation we need in the world, even with the governments and repressive regimes that we don't like. But still, Putin obviously is a thug who's running something of a kleptocratic state there, where people like you and I, journalists, run the risk of being murdered for, looking at anything that inconveniences the oligarchs or the state or Putin himself. And, I don't see how anyone on the right or the left or the middle can be supportive of this. And I think we're in a whole new era that's in some ways post-ideological. So, trying to fall back into the old categories of left-right, McCarthyism, or détente, whatever you want to call it, doesn't really fit any longer. So it's quite clear that what Russia did in terms of our election is just flat out wrong, whether it's coming from a communist party, a capitalist kleptocracy or autocracy. It's just wrong. The most important thing in our political system is the security and the sanctity of our voting process. We spend a lot of time making sure that people have voting rights here. And on the left, people rally and organize if that's threatened. This is exactly the same thing. This is undermining the people's right to freely choose their leaders. And in this last election, the stakes were particularly high. So why anybody would sort of start, poo-pooing this is beyond me. And it certainly seems that, Julian Assange played a very active role here. And again, we see now Russia working to elect nationalists or proto-fascists in France and in Germany. It's quite clear that Putin doesn't like liberal, democracies in the classic sense of the word, and that he wants to have, Europe be weak. I'm not a big fan of NATO, but he wants Europe to be weak so that there's no counterbalance to his assertion of power. And, mucking around with democracy in France and Germany, here in the United States, it's not good for anybody. And I don't know why there's even a debate over that. Well, how Jill Stein could go sit at a gala with Vladimir Putin and then have on the same table General Michael Flynn is beyond me. The guy, is a war criminal in certain ways, and he is a thug, and he doesn't deserve that respect or that honor. At the same time, we should be careful of those people who want to drive towards a militaristic aggression towards Russia.
Well, during the campaign, you met with the MI6 officer, Christopher Steele, who prepared a dossier originally, I believe, for opposition research for Republicans and then later for Democrats. And my understanding is that he had got this to the FBI via the Rome office and was incredibly frustrated that the FBI was doing nothing to look into this dossier. And eventually he came over here and visited with you. Is that correct?
I have not identified. I was the first person to write out the series of memos from a former counterintelligence officer that described a Russian effort to co-opt and cultivate Donald Trump, and that included gathering compromising information on him. I never identified, and I have not identified, the name of that person or what his nationality was or is. So I have not spoken into details about my communications with that person. I will just say that as I reported before the election on October 31st last year, that in the course of him pulling together these memos, they were not a dossier. There was a series of memos reporting back to a research firm that had hired him. In the course of doing those memos, he became alarmed at what he was finding, and he decided to share them with the FBI. He had contacts, pre-existing contacts with the FBI from his days working in intelligence, and that the FBI did respond to him at some point. They did ask for more information and how he knew what he knew, and they did ask for him to keep sending information to him. But obviously nothing happened in the fall, and I can't speak to his motives, but I did communicate with him in the fall and was the first to write a story about this counterintelligence officer and the memos.
Well, we know that after the recent meeting of the House with Comey, the FBI director, that many congresspeople came out. I spoke with Congressman Ted Lieu at the time. Maxine Waters came out, and she was fuming, saying that the FBI director has no credibility. So is he slow-walking this thing? I mean, I mentioned in the opening that...
There are a couple... We in the public don't have enough details to know exactly what they're mad about. We have seen some indications. We saw Ron Wyden in January question Director Comey at an open hearing in which he basically said, will you declassify information you have on links between Trump associates in Russia? Now, he didn't say what that information was, but he certainly, and Comey said no, he wouldn't, and he wouldn't talk about any such investigation. But this, to me, was a clear indication that Ron Wyden, who sits on the Intelligence Committee, has seen or been briefed on information within the FBI that is about that gets to the issue of associations between people close to Trump and Russian officials or intermediaries. In the fall, Harry Reid was saying that he'd seen hair-raising information. In November, Wyden and six other members of the Intelligence Committee, all Democrats, sent a letter to Obama asking him to declassify more information on the connection between Russia and the election. So clearly, there are members of the House and Senate who have seen things that you and I have not, and that they, you know, have pushed for them to come out. And Comey hasn't released that. Also, neither has Obama, who could have before the election or after the election. There are many ways to sort of look at this, and it could be, you know, one explanation could be that the investigations conducted by Comey and the FBI into links between Trump's inner circle and Russia produced nothing and petered out, and that the associations that they are the links or communications or interactions they were looking at proved to be, you know, innocent or innocuous. It could be that some of this information that they have has come from such sensitive sources and methods, you know, such as, you know, intercepts or human agents that have penetrated, you know, important circles within Moscow, that they can't release this information. It could be that this is part of what would be known as a counterintelligence investigation, which is not a criminal investigation. And therefore, the information doesn't get used in court and can't be discussed as openly as, say, the investigation of Hillary's email servers. These are sort of two different things. So there are many different possible answers about what Comey is or has done or hasn't done. But the truth of the matter is, the ultimate truth is that we don't know. So I can't say he's slow walking. I can't say he's, sitting on things. My personal take on him is that he tends to be a straight shooter and follows the rules. Now, sometimes the rules end up protecting people because we like, civil liberties protected, and you don't get and information doesn't make it out to the public. But I know a lot of people out there have called for him to resign and are mad at him. I would say this, I would rather have Comey remain in the position than have Rudy Giuliani get the job or be the guy who picks the next FBI chief.
Well, arguably Donald Trump has lowered the bar in that regard, if those are the choices. But just in closing, what about the general context here of the daily antics of Donald Trump, the constantly being distracted, the Sean Spicer kind of follies, and the general idea that a lot of political people are heading up the DNI, the CIA, and the chairs of both the Senate and House committees. So can you conspire to shut something down that's such a smoking gun as this story?
Well, that's a good question. I hope the answer is no, that there are enough people within the bureaucracy, career servants, put aside the politicos, who if they saw something being shut down or smothered, they would find a way to bring it out to the public. We have seen that already in the first weeks of the Trump administration, where there are obviously people working the White House or the State Department or Defense Department who have been horrified by Trump's interactions with other world leaders, and they've leaked transcripts of these, or detailed descriptions of these calls to reporters, to just, I think, as a cry for help in some ways. So that's, ultimately what we have to sort of fall back on, that the whole system is not full of just corrupt, craven people, and that there are some people who will step forward. I do know that there are, senators, Democrats and Republicans, and members of the House, Democrats, not too many Republicans, actually, who are committed to seeing this come out and to have a good investigation. And they're watching what the intelligence committees are doing. It wasn't their preferred path. They would have had an independent outside commission or a select committee that would have been made up of more people, not just the intelligence committees. But they're watching closely, and they've all stated, even John McCain and Lindsey Graham have said this on the Republican side, that if they don't see a good investigation, they're going to demand an outside investigation. So I'm hoping they keep their words. A lot of this stuff is, can be discerned. If you have a subpoena, if you can go, take testimony from people, if you can look at people's credit card and travel records, you can figure out and find out a lot. So these investigations are not beyond the ability of people in Washington to conduct them. And I still have hope that we will get some answers. And I just hope, too, that this remains a topic for the media and for others to keep talking about and to covering, and that it doesn't slip to the side as we deal, myself included, day to day with all the craziness coming out of the Trump White House.
And, of course, the president himself, who one would think would want to remove the cloud of illegitimacy that hovers over him, doesn't show any interest whatsoever. In fact, he almost shows hostility to the idea of clearing the air here. So that in itself raises certain questions. And I thank you for joining us, David Cohen.
It does. Yeah, and I encourage people to go to motherjones.com, see the story I put up today about this, and to also, I tweet about this a lot at David Cohen DC on Twitter.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, David Cohen.
Thank you. Bye.
And again, I've been speaking with David Cohen, who's the Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine. He's written for numerous publications and is a talk show regular, and his best-selling books include Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin, Scandal, and The Selling of the Iraq War. And his latest article at Mother Jones is The Mysterious Disappearance of the Biggest Scandal in Washington. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the alliance between Donald Trump's chief strategist, Stephen Bannon, and hardliners in the Vatican who oppose Pope Francis. But they beg you, wait, my name. I got one hell of a job, performed for the U.S. of A.
secret agent man. Bernard, I see Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in the second chance? Do you believe in rapture, babe?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor and the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. His latest book is The Invisible Bestseller. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Briggs.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Kenneth, what do you make of the this recent flurry of stories, starting with the New York Times this week, of revealing a close friendship between Stephen Bannon, the strategist in the White House, who's made himself a member of the National Security Council? The New York Times recently, an editorial suggested he was a de facto president. He's certainly a kind of Cardinal Richelieu Rasputin figure, by all accounts, in this White House, headed by somebody who seems to be out of his depth and perhaps even out of his mind. And there is this, apparently this a bond that was established a number of years back between Cardinal Burke, Raymond Burke being the American cardinal, very arch-conservative and traditionalist in the Vatican, who has openly clashed with Pope Francis. Whether he's responsible for the leaflets that have been floating around Rome and the Vatican, critical of the Pope, we don't know. But let's start with that overall premise. Is there a sort of pushback from the conservatives against this pope? Doesn't he live in the hotel and eats meals in the cafeteria? Some people think it's because he doesn't want to be poisoned.
I think it's fair to say that there's been a pushback against this pope almost from the very beginning by, I hesitate to put it quite this way, but it's by the usual suspects. There's always been a tension between traditionalists, as they're generally referred to, and people who prefer to move ahead in the world and become more reformists. And that was very present at the Second Vatican Council. Before the council began, the traditionalists thought they were in control, and the progressives came in and said, we're going to abandon the agenda that's been set before us, and we're going to make it brand new, and we're going to introduce a different spirit to it. So there's been the tension between very old and not so old for a long time, and I think this fits that pattern pretty well. And a few of the cardinals got together and protested the Pope's encyclical on married life, and it included a portion on whether divorced and remarried Catholics could receive communion, and that triggered a response from this cluster of very conservative bishops, cardinals, who sent a direct statement to the Pope saying, we disagree with you, we're on the other side, and we think your views, I believe this is almost verbatim, your view might have to be corrected. So the battle has been on for some time. I don't think it's terribly extensive, although the Curia itself, the huge bureaucracy in Rome, has generally opposed change, and the Pope at least symbolizes a great deal of change, so that has brought about some degree of strength to the dissidents. How much, I don't know. It's interesting, too, that dissidents, when used to apply to lay people when they disagree with church doctrine, is considered a very bad thing by conservatives. a sign of betrayal. But when this group of top cardinals voices its dissent in very strong terms, it's seen as an effort to save the true church. So interpretation is very important. But the Pope, I just have to say to end the answer to this, the Pope, I think, has been pretty assertive in standing up to it and probably reducing the degree to which it could spread, at least openly. So he has not been sitting back taking this lightly.
Well, the recent New York Times article that I referred to, Kenneth, it was fairly clear in suggesting that this Pope, who's a very genial, avuncular figure and seems like a really sweet man, and certainly has shown great grace and compassion, is also behind the walls of the Vatican is a tough politician. And he, you know, these people like Cardinal Raymond Burke refer to themselves, and in fact, I think Stephen Bannon coined the phrase as trad rads, traditional radicals. Radical traditionalists. And it's amazing, just in the context of you know, the kind of Borgia-like intrigue in the Vatican. Didn't the Pope clip Cardinal Burke's wings by firing him as the head of this secretive organization, the Knights of Malta?
He basically pushed him aside. Cardinal Burke was still kind of licking his wounds from having been pushed out of inner circles within the Vatican, as the Pope made it clear that he preferred the co-leadership of other cardinals other than Burke, who had been quite critical of him. So he'd been pushed aside, and he landed at the Knights of Malta as their special spiritual representative from the Vatican. And then recently the Pope moved to displace the head of the Knights of Malta because of certain actions that are still not quite clear. But the Pope moved to remove him from that position, and in the process, Cardinal Burke seems to have been pushed aside from that job, too. So he's been increasingly marginalized in the power structure.
Well, Bannon has hired this former priest, Thomas Williams, as Breitbart's Rome correspondent. Williams belonged to the Legion of Christ, which, of course, was headed up by that Spanish pedophile, and that's been consumed by scandal. And he himself, Williams, when he was a priest, fathered a child that he kept secret until he was outed by a news report in Italy, and now he married the child's mother, who's the daughter of the former U.S. ambassador to the Vatican. So I must say that's pretty tabloidy stuff, isn't it? I mean, where are all of these? Where's the great Catholic traditions of family values and abstinence when it comes to that? So very strange, very strange. So
it's hard to know whether his motives are an enlargement of his personal quest to have some connection with the Catholic rite, whether it's an avocational kind of thing, or whether he is attempting to form bonds and alliances with the Catholic rite at the Vatican as a means of exercising a certain amount of influence over the Catholic rite in this country. And it's far from clear what exactly his primary motive is.
Well, so far he was very successful in getting a lot of conservative Catholics to vote for Donald Trump. So to that extent, he's already succeeded. I thank you for joining us here today, Kenneth Briggs.
Thank you very much.
And again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Portrayal of American Nuns. And his latest book is The Invisible Bestseller. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into whether Donald Trump is a bully and whether Mitch McConnell bullied Senator Elizabeth Warren. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Andrew Fass, who's an author, activist, philanthropist, and management advisor promoting psychologically healthy, safe, and fair workplaces. Having led some of Canada's largest corporations for over three decades as a senior executive, he's currently partnering with the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence on emotional revolution in the workplace. He also founded the FAST Foundation, which supports nonprofit organizations concerned with workplace well-being and other personal health and research endeavors. And he's the author of From Bully to Bullseye, Move Your Organization Out of the Line of Fire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Fass.
Thanks, Ian.
And many people think that we do have a bully in the White House, and that is a pretty significant organization that Donald Trump presides over, the executive branch of the United States. Of course, he's not just the commander-in-chief, he's also the head of state. And we in this republic here in the United States, of course, have both a political leader and a head of state in the one person. And many people are concerned by President Trump's behavior. But it does seem in many ways that his campaign persona is, to some people, it seems like bullying. To others, it seems like sort of macho, no-nonsense leadership. So how do you clarify those different perceptions?
Well, it's yes, people look at it and look at him as being authentic. And where I would make a distinction to say, yes, I think he does say what's on his mind in a very brutal way, and that's not actually bullying. But where it comes in, where bullying really manifests itself, is in some of his actions, and more on his actions, quite frankly, than his words. And the retaliatory approach he takes with anyone who goes against him. And I think that's the biggest factor that I look at. And the other is the distortion. So my definition of a bully is bullies are masters of manipulation, deception, deflection, deceit, and retaliatory action. And he fits that profile perfectly. And you're quite right. I think people did understand, based on his words, what they were getting into. But one thing that I really struggle with is watching him take a playbook out of what occurred in Europe in the early 30s and what occurred with McCarthyism. And it is, in my view and the view of many others that I have gotten a lot of reaction from, when we did a quick post, does your bully remind you of, does Donald Trump remind you of your boss? And the amount of reaction I got from that was incredible. And it opened, quite frankly, it opened people's eyes as to what they're
the workplace. And my book is on workplace bullying, and that's what I focused on. But what I found now is people are really, it's really resonating with people to say, Jesus, you know, I just accepted the way my boss is or the environment that I work in as that's just the way it is. And there's really nothing I can do about it. And probing further, these people were working in toxic environments that are not very democratic. And what I see here is a breakdown of democracy. And the other thing I'm really concerned about is the checks and balances that should be in place are very fragile. And the most recent being his comments on the justices who even haven't weighed down on where out and out chastising them. And when he does that, he chastises the whole system. And by calling the judge who issued the order last week, his terminology was
a so-called judge. Right.
And you know, that justice is number one, a highly, highly, highly respected justice with a conservative bent.
Right.
And for the nominee to even take issue with that to the Supreme Court, you know, which suggests that there is something amiss here. Now, I've got to tell you, I am an expert in human and organizational dynamics, and that's what I spent the bulk of my time working with. And organizational dynamics are human dynamics. And it's usually set by the leader, and if an organization is a dictatorial organization, there's a dictator at the head. It's not a rogue employee or group of employees. It's set at the very, very top. And in society, I think this is what we're experiencing today. And I'm, you know, personally very, very concerned that not enough of us are thinking in time to really understand the implications of that.
And again, I'm speaking with Andrew Fass, who's an author, activist, philanthropist, and management advisor promoting psychologically healthy, safe and fair workplaces. He has led some of Canada's largest corporations for over three decades as a senior executive and currently is in partnership with the Yale University Center for Emotional Intelligence on Emotion Revolution in the Workplace. And his latest book is From Bully to Bullseye, Move Your Organization Out of the Line of Fire. And I want to get to, obviously, to Elizabeth Warren being shut down, which many women see as being a kind of a patriarchal slapdown, but also others have seen as a kind of form of bullying, since the male senators read the same letter from Coretta Scott King, and they weren't told to shut up and sit down. But just to finish up on the difference between corporations and government, which is a democratic structure, aren't corporations in effect authoritarian by nature? Do you think because Trump comes out of a corporate world where he's the head of his own private company and answers to nobody, is that, do you think, conditions him to have this kind of authoritarian response? I'm not trying to make excuses for him, but I'm trying to put him in context.
Yeah, and you know, quite frankly, most organizations are authoritarian. Most good organizations are more democratic, and where an employee, whether it's a executive or a janitor, has a freedom of expression. And in a world where organizations are dependent on innovation and creativity, to grow their particular business, and most organizations are, than to shut down the voice of the employee. Organizations do that at their peril. And organizations that are more open and allow the freedom of expression, allow degrees of autonomy, allow for people to make decisions while being micromanaged, those organizations, in my experience, for those organizations that I worked for and ran, and for organizations I've consulted with, have yielded greater returns and were able to attract the best and the brightest. But getting back to Trump, I think he learned what he learned a lot earlier than when he became a CEO of a huge organization. And I'm not a psychologist, but I spend a fair time with psychologists. And my view of the guy is he is in need of some serious help.
Elaborate on that, if you will.
Well, in my book, I cover off and I recommend when an organization hires anybody in a management position, they should have a independent psychological evaluation done on anybody either promoted to a management position or hired into a management position. And there's no one single bullet that can predict how people are going to behave in a work environment or in any kind of environment. And the closest thing that I found is having psychological assessments done on people. A lot of, in my experience, when we expect that's done in the hiring process, and there are no exceptions, whether it's a board member or a CEO or a mid-level management manager, it predicts how an individual will behave in the workplace and the type of manager he's going to be. And the chapter of the book is called "Is There a Psychopath in the House?" And I outline the characteristics of a psychopath. And again, I am not an expert. I do not expect people who are not professionals to administer those tests. But my pretty vast experience in terms of having people go through this, it's a pretty good indicator relative to whether or not somebody has a certain mental health condition. And it's unfortunate that is not part of the vetting process, if you will. But I question, his mental state.
Well, the video of his comments about women, of course, was widely played before the elections, the Access Hollywood video. And I think even though it was an unguarded moment, I think it also basically shows his attitudes towards women, and it appalled a lot of women. And the treatment of Senator Elizabeth Warren on the Senate floor by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has also appalled women. So what is the connection between men as abusers, as chauvinists? There's obviously a lot of range between those two statements, and bullies.
Well, the reality is it's still an old boys' club out there. So there is that inherent bias. But if you relay this in terms of a crony of and an advisor to Trump, and that's Roger Ailes, where it was an open secret that that organization was a hotbed for sexually abusing females in that organization. And a lot of people, look at Trump's comments about grabbing the genitalia, or that was kind of brushed off as locker room language. I've spent a lot of time in locker rooms in a lot of environments, and I got to tell you, that is rare in a locker room of adults. So you may get it, in the younger years, but for a, I forget how old he was at the time, but he was well over 50, and it is a reflection of how certain category of men view women.
Well, the most recent exhibition of bullying coming from Trump himself, you know, irrespective of what just happened on the Senate floor with Elizabeth Warren, was with a meeting with a group of sheriffs just a couple of days ago. One of the sheriffs from Texas mentioned that a lawmaker in Texas wanted to change the asset forfeiture laws so that you can't just seize somebody's property unless they've actually been convicted. And as it stands now, they're able to seize it just on the suspicion of crime, which in itself seems to be unconstitutional. But that's another argument. But in general, the guy was explaining, and he wouldn't, the sheriff wouldn't give the name of the lawmaker. But Trump asked, "Who is he?" And he said he didn't. When there was silence, he said, "Well, you know, I'll find out who he is, and I'll destroy his career." Now, of course, that was passed off, brushed off again, not so much as locker room talk, but as a joke. But it's very hard for me not to see there's an attitude behind that joke, even if you accept the idea that it was a joke.
Well, Ian, you know, if it were a single event, you know, over a period of time, but this is an almost everyday event. And if he, you know, if he says, "Oh, no, I was just joking," you know, was he just joking about blasting Nordstrom for not carrying his daughter's brand? And what he's doing is testing and pushing the envelope to the point where people are just going to give up and say, "Well, we're just stuck with this guy for 4 years because he can do anything." And when I talk about the how fragile the checks and balances are, the challenge to Warren by the Republican leader was, you know, a flagrant negligence, and there are many stronger words for it, on somebody that we should be looking to say, how can we control this guy?
Well, look, the American people, at least a minority of them, voted for this man, and this is a candidate who said, "I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it." So it's not like he did. He didn't signal.
He's not surprising.
Exactly. So let me just.
The danger on that, Ian, is that he is normalizing the abnormal.
And people by accepting him are normalized. If you accept him, you're normalizing the abnormal. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And the other is that he is, you know, he's a role model. Whether he's a good role model or a bad role model, he's a role model. And by behaving and talking the way he's talking, and it gives people a license to do the same thing.
Well, you know, the First Lady, Michelle Obama, basically tried to make that point. She did it extremely passionately and eloquently.
Yes, she did.
Well, let's just, in the last couple of minutes then, turn to Melania, who many people think looks like a battered wife. I don't know what the evidence is. That's just the perceptions that people have, you know, a sort of Stepford wife kind of demeanor. But the one thing that she was given as a role or as a cause during the convention was that she would be a champion against bullying. And many people thought that that was extremely cynical. So what did you make of that? And by the way, it doesn't look like anything has come of it. She's not even living with him, and she's taking a pretty low-profile role.
Well, to be honest, I think she is a very misunderstood individual. People look at her as the, you know, someone who is totally under the thumb. I think she is basically saying, "Listen, you wanted this, I don't want it, and I'm going to be First Lady in accordance to what I believe I want to do and can do. The comment about the cyberbullying, I think that was very genuine, and that was not a manipulated comment. And I think that was a signal to the president by saying, you know, you're a cyber bully, and I'm going to take on for my son and his generation the cause of cyberbullying. So it was kind of a whack across the bow. And I commend her for doing that. The other is the pussy scarf she wore at one event after he made the comment, the locker room, supposed locker room comment. And that was well thought out by her and brilliant.
So you think she's a little subversive?
I think she's a revolutionist. and quite frankly, I hope she is.
Right, right. Well, I don't know whether anybody has any influence over him. He's supposedly the only person that has much influence over him is his daughter and his son-in-law, not to mention, of course, the dark Svengali Darth Vader figure, Stephen Bannon.
Well, on him having influence on the son-in-law and daughter, the comments being made about Jews against, and I'm not Jewish, but the comments that are made about Jews by Bannon and his policies that are anti-Semitic, the comments that Trump is making about women, why did Ivanka and, what's her husband's name?
Jared Kushner.
Jared, if they had influence, he wouldn't have said that. Those comments wouldn't have been made.
Well,
I think Jared was influential in getting rid of Christie, and that was a retaliatory against what Christie did to his father. I don't disagree with that, by the way. But I really question whether or not the two of them have much sway.
Well, Andrew Fass, let's stay in touch, because I do believe we have a bully in the White House, and we also have bullies in the Senate, and this minority government hitting the ground running, and they're making drastic and radical changes in America. It's the most right-wing government we've ever had, probably in the country's history. And there'll be, I think, more evidence of what you're talking about and what you're trying to eradicate in the workplace. And I thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for helping me continue the debate and the conversation on it.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Fass, who's an author, activist, philanthropist, and management advisor promoting psychologically healthy, safe, and fair workplaces. Having led some of Canada's largest corporations for over three decades as a senior executive, he's currently partnering with the Yale University Center for Emotional Intelligence on emotion revolution in the workplace, and also founded the Fass Foundation. And his latest book is From Bully to Bullseye: Move Your Organization Out of the Line of Fire. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.